Well, hello, everybody, and thanks for joining in on this part of the weekly discussion where our focus is on the spiritual seasons of the year and how they relate to the weekly Torah portion. This week, we'll be briefly looking at portion Miketz before turning to Vayigash and spending much of our time there. So by way of review, which I like to do at the beginning here each time, we've been establishing that the second half of the year, starting in the seventh month, is a time for maturing in the Lord, what we're calling adulthood. The fall is the time of the year when the young girl, who is rescued from Egypt in the spring, reaches a point of maturity to where she grows into being the bride of the King of the universe. During this fall part of the yearly salvation pattern, we have to release the old life and learn a new identity within our marriage to God. We learn to step up and offer him not only consistent keeping of Torah commandments, but also expressions of love for our groom that go beyond what he has commanded. We see examples of this going beyond the commandment with the holidays of Hanukkah and Purim, two celebrations added to the calendar by the bride, right? Israel added those to the calendar. You know, Israel said, we don't have to do this. It's not commanded, but here's what we want to do for God because he's done great things for us in these seasons. So anyway, that's an example of that. In recent teachings, we've talked about the central role that the New Covenant plays in this season. The root of the New Covenant is Torah written in the gut and heart. The way God empowers us to walk out the Torah consistently is by helping us to get excited about the Torah and become passionate about the Torah, engaging our emotions for it. Part of this involves him opening it up for us so that we can see him in the hidden places there. So the New Covenant is critical in engaging our passion for Torah and empowering us to walk by it. Last week, we talked about how the month of Kislev brings us, at least by the end of the month, to a point of rest, when the work of salvation shifts from being especially inward to now being more outward in the deep winter. We said that this point of inner completion is associated with our light starting to shine outwardly, and that shining light is also associated with a new kind of persecution as the darkness is exposed for what it is, right? Our light exposes the darkness. So this week, we will continue with this idea of a turning point in the year from the completion of an inner work to a more outward emphasis. So the last quarter of the year is going to have this more outward focus. Portions Miketz and Vayigash form a very distinct line in the sand. So keep this in mind. We're talking about a turning point. All of this is talking about a turning point. And we want to see how we can see this turning point in the story of Joseph that we're reading about in the Torah portions. We'll see the text pointing us to a small number of verses that are a picture of this climactic moment that marks this shift from inner to outer, from truth to action. I'm sure you can already think of where that climactic point is. There's a lot of ideas in this teaching today. Don't be concerned if you are struggling a little bit. Just take what comes. All of these ideas come around again and again. So don't put pressure on yourself. All right, so let's begin in Miketz. The portion starts with Pharaoh having two dreams and Joseph being brought out of prison to interpret them. Joseph is appointed to run the country. During the years of plenty, Joseph stores up vast amounts of seed. During the years of famine, he begins distributing the seed, the grain. It's in Miketz that Joseph brilliantly sets up his brothers with the great test. As the portion ends, Joseph's plan to frame Benjamin is successful, And he takes Benjamin from the brothers for stealing his goblet. And that's where the portion ends. It's a real cliffhanger. The tension in the portion builds and builds to this climactic moment and stops just before Judah draws near to speak to Joseph. So Micaiah brings the season of the fall to a close. The portion is read during Hanukkah, which itself crosses over the line from the fall to the winter, crossing from the ninth month to the tenth month. And we have the winter solstice right there. So 9 months is the duration of pregnancy. There's about to be a kind of a birth, right? We're crossing from the ninth to the tenth month here. The name Micaiah itself means at the end and is from the root to cut off. The portion is drawing a sharp line by cutting the action off at what feels like an unnatural point, right? Why did they have to choose that point? Just at the moment, the climactic moment, they cut the portion off. So why are they choosing such an unnatural point to do that? It's telling us that everything that happens after this line belongs to a different spiritual season. The inner work is done. The outer work begins. Again, that's our focus today, is this turning point. This turning point. What do Joseph and Judah, for example, have to do with this turning point? Well, what is the moment it's pointing to? If you blinked, you might have missed it. Let's turn to the portion Vayigash now and consider these important verses that the structure of the Torah portions and the physical seasons and the holiday of Hanukkah are all pointing us toward. It is the moment, like I said, when Judah draws near to Joseph and tries to rescue Benjamin from Joseph's hand. In fact, the meaning of the word Vayigash is to draw near, and he drew near. It's all leading us to the coming together of Judah and Joseph and what happens there. So there's an important sub-story in the Torah that has to do with these two brothers in particular, and we need to become sensitive to it. We're going to see this thread all throughout Scripture, this Judah and Joseph thread, and so we need to see the origin of it, what it's supposed to look like, what the purpose of it is. We're seeing that right here in this interaction. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it, since it's so important to the seasons and to this teaching here today. Starting in Genesis 44:18. Then Judah went up to him and said, "Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ears, and let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself." My Lord asked his servants, saying, "Have you a father or a brother?" And we said to my Lord, "We have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him." Then you said to your servants, "Bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him." You know, basically, Judah's saying, look, we told you how important this kid is to his father, and yet you still said, bring him down, right? Judah's trying to say, what are you doing here? We said to my Lord, "The boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die." Then you said to your servants, "Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again." When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. And when our father said, "Go again, buy us a little food," we said, "We can't go down. If our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down. For we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us." Then your servant, my father, said to us, "You know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me, and I said, 'Surely he has been torn to pieces,' and I've never seen him since. If you take this one also from me and harm happens to him, you will bring down my gray hair in evil to Sheol. Now, therefore, as soon as I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, or slave to Joseph, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, make everyone go out from me. So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud, so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. You got to love the understatement of the Torah sometimes. They were dismayed at his presence, right? Yeah, they were probably pulling their hair out and saying, what is going on here? So that's it. That's what it's all leading us to. The structure of the Torah portions, Miketz and Vayigash, and the lights of Hanukkah starting to show on the outside, and the winter solstice forming a line for us in the year, all of it is pointing to this moment when Judah draws near to Joseph. So let's try to understand what's happening here in the light of the salvation pattern, right? I'm calling this structure, this salvation in the year and everywhere else, the salvation pattern. I only have a glimmer of what's going on here, I have to say, but I'll put it out there as one perspective among many to build upon as we continue to walk with these portions in this cycle, year after year. Here's a little, this, let this be a seed teaching to put some ideas in your head. So first of all, let's note that Joseph and Judah are two names that are associated with being at odds with each other. We see the tension between them in the history of Israel, where the northern kingdom comes to be known as Joseph or Ephraim, which is Joseph's son, and the southern kingdom comes to be known as Judah. They end up not only not getting along, but they split from each other into two kingdoms. But even long before this Joseph-Judah split happens in history, there's a kind of tension very early regarding the birthright. We're told in 1 Chronicles, it's a fascinating verse there in 1 Chronicles, that the birthright passes from Reuben to Joseph. Okay, easy enough. Joseph gets the birthright. But hang on, it's not quite so simple. So listen for how Judah somehow gets into the mix in this passing on of the birthright. In 1 Chronicles chapter 5, it says, Reuben was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's couch, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph. Though Judah became strong among his brothers and a chief came from him, yet the birthright belonged to Joseph, right? It's saying it passed from Reuben to Joseph, but Judah became strong among his brothers. So somehow Judah is included in this conversation of the birthright. It's almost like the birthright was split into two. Joseph gets a double portion in that two tribes descended from Joseph both inherit equally with the other tribes, while Judah gets the responsibility of leading the tribes, becoming the tribe from which the kings will come, right? Those are the two aspects of the birthright, the double portion and leading the family. That gets split almost between these two brothers and these two tribes. Now, God does not intend for two of the tribes to be permanently at odds. That's not part of his design. These two are connected for good reasons, for salvation reasons. And so we will see that, in a way, they're almost married to each other, these two tribes. And so let's see if we can dig into that a little bit. In Jewish thinking, Joseph is a tzaddik, a righteous one. So they have a very particular way of using this word tzaddik for a few individuals over the years who were the righteous ones in their generations, the very special righteous one. In the last teaching, we talked about how Joseph is a kind of point of inner maturity. Joseph represents the accumulation of the spiritual growth in the family up to that point. Joseph has the faith of Abraham. He has the Torah knowledge of Isaac. Remember, Isaac is always digging or redigging wells. Well, over time, the sages have come to look at that as Torah knowledge, this water that he's finding. So Joseph has the knowledge of Isaac. He has the faith of Abraham. And he also has the upper-lower connectedness that we see in Jacob, with Jacob reuniting with Esau. That's kind of the main story of Jacob's life. And so this is the coming back together of the spiritual and the physical. And with that connection comes a kind of emotional connection, an emotional intelligence, and even a prophetic intelligence. He has it all. All of that comes to Joseph, and is also good looking. So he inherits all this from the womb. And this is why his brothers are so jealous of him. In the last teaching, we talked about the emergence of Joseph as a point of inner rest and the beginning of a more outward work. And this outward work is necessary for Joseph because for much of his story, he's really not in control of his outer world. He has everything except control. So point number one, who is Joseph? Joseph is the tzaddik. Joseph is the one who has everything to pass on because it was all passed on to him. So Joseph has to find a way to give what he has passed on. He's the righteous one. He's the source of great inspiration, but also the source of jealousy, a source of jealousy. So obviously we can see in Joseph many parallels with the Messiah, who is the tzaddik. And when Grant teaches this portion and about Joseph, he's very often talking about all the connections between Joseph and Joshua, or Joseph and Yeshua. So Yeshua is the righteous one for the whole world, right? Joseph is a shadow of Yeshua. Joseph is the Messiah figure in his generation. So what Joseph is to his generation, Yeshua is to every generation and the entire world. But guess what? The Messiah is not the goal. And Joseph is not the goal. Joseph has to pass something on. He has to pass on something that he's been given. The goal is actually found with Judah. The Messiah comes to bring something out from within humanity so that humanity can transcend to a higher level like Judah does. In some ways, the Messiah is a midwife bringing out from within humanity our full potential. The realization of that potential is the goal. And we find that realization in Judah. And we get a clue that Joseph is not the goal when we look at the meanings of their names. So Joseph means, may he add, indicating that we're still waiting for something more, another step. Joseph implies giving, and giving needs a receiver. The receiver is the end point, not the giver. Yehuda, Judah, on the other hand, means praise or admit. Right? The essence of praise is admitting. Oh God, you are so much higher than I am. Right? That's admitting. Admitting is a response after something is realized, when you've gotten to the end of the thing. When you see that someone else is higher and better and more righteous than you, you admit to that. In other words, you praise. The name Yehuda is also connected to the word hand, which is yad, and gives us the picture of hands lifted in praise of Adonai, as if we're coming to the end of something in our walk with Adonai, and we've experienced his deliverance, and we're holding our hands up in praise and admitting to God that he is in a superior position, and he holds all the power and sway in the universe. This is an end gesture. Oh my goodness, I see that you've worked everything out for my good. Now I see it. That's a realization. And I lift my hands up. Praise the Lord. You are so much more in control of my life than I am. Right? Yehuda comes at the end, not Joseph. So if Judah is the goal, who is Judah? Judah is understood to be the critical point of action. within the 12 tribes. So let me say that again. Judah is the key to action in the body of Israel. Judah is where all the spirituality is translated into doing in the real world, which is one reason the temple is partly built in Judah's territory, because the temple is partly about translating the spiritual into real world action. I lay my hands on that animal and it is a sacrifice on my behalf. Again, Judah is the key to this moment of transition from the inner work to the outer, more action-oriented work. So until this week, I didn't know that Judah was seen in this light, this action. Action is in Judah. I didn't know that. But it makes perfect sense that we're reading especially about Judah now, because this is exactly what we should be looking for at this point in the year when we are moving from the ninth month to the tenth, from fall to winter. Because with this transition of seasons, God is helping us to change our emphasis, as we've been saying, from the inner work to the outer action-oriented work. So here is the goal Judah is aiming for with, I'm sorry, Joseph. Here's the goal that Joseph is aiming for with all his machinations and testing of the brothers. Joseph brings out of Judah a humble lowering down in service, a surrender of his own life in service to others. As it turns out, this lowering down results in God raising him up to the place of leadership among his brothers. So this lowering down is the goal. The lowering down of surrendering one's own life in service to others. In this case, Judah says, take me as your slave and let Benjamin go. He's trying to, above all, serve his elderly father by sparing him the loss of Benjamin. Judah's making a great sacrifice indeed here, giving up everything, you know, and for Benjamin of all brothers. Why do I say Benjamin of all brothers? Well, Benjamin is now taking the place of the despised Joseph, right? He's the other son of Rachel. And the most beloved of the father. Now, though, rather than getting rid of his brother, Judah says, take me instead of him. Right? Judah is like, I know I'm not the favorite. I know Benjamin is the favorite. Now, take me instead of him. I can't do this to my father. So it's a vast transformation that has happened in Judah. So this kind of surrender is what service to others always is. We lower ourselves down to be someone else's slave in a way. And what we find is that God raises us up. It's like that in our fellowships too. I recall Grant saying that one of the guiding principles we've had here at BT over the years is that when there's a need to appoint another elder, the current elders look around for the men who are already doing the service work within the body, because those are the ones who are best suited to be raised up to the position of the head, the eldership. And that's what we see happen with the tribe of Judah, with God making them the royal tribe, the tribe of Israel's kings. So there's another important point to draw out here. Without Joseph finagling and manipulating to give Judah the chance to make his big decision, Judah is not able to express his essence. Judah's essence is action with the hands that brings praise to God. So that's Judah's name, but he isn't really Judah until this moment when he offers to give up everything for the sake of Benjamin and the sake of his father. You don't get the fullness of Judah without the help of Joseph. So by the same token, Judah's need gives Joseph the chance to be Joseph. Joseph is essentially the idea of giving, right? May he add. That's the name Joseph. Joseph's essence is giving, guiding, which is what we see him doing all throughout his life. Judah elicits from Joseph, Judah elicits from Joseph, Joseph's highest form of giving. Judah's journey requires a kind of guidance that only Joseph can give. So Judah also helps Joseph to be Joseph. So these two are intimately connected. They are designed to complement each other, almost like husband and wife, right? Without Judah, Joseph can't be the fullness of Joseph. Without Joseph, Judah can't be the fullness of Judah. Okay. I'm not sure if I just got that wrong, but you get the point. So the Haftorah for Vayigash 2 is a beautiful image of the bigger picture of how these two are working together. So here are the first three verses of the Haftorah from Ezekiel 37. The word of the Lord came to me, "Son of man, take a stick and write on it for Judah and the people of Israel associated with him. Then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel associated with him, and join them one to another into one stick, that they may become one in your hand." The two sticks of Judah and Joseph are meant to come together in the hand to become one stick. So let's make one more connection now between this discussion and the calendar. The centrality of this image of the hands raised in praise to God, the essence of Judah, hands mean action too, by the way, is expressed in the calendar. So this is expressed in the calendar at this time of year in the tradition that the Hallel be read every day of Hanukkah. So the Hallel is the recitation, just verbatim, of Psalms 113 to 118, which are all Psalms of praise. And the Hallel is not read a lot during the year. It's only read 21 times during the year, that it has to be read. And eight of those 21 are the 8 days of Hanukkah. So for the observant Jews, this reading of the Hallel is deeply connected to Hanukkah. All right, so let's shift our focus more squarely to Yeshua. Again, Joseph is like the Messiah in that Joseph is a tzaddik, a righteous one. The tzaddik serves as a bridge between God and a generation. So think about that in terms of Joseph and Judah. Joseph is the bridge between God, what God has built up in this family and given to this one to pass on to another one. That is what the tzaddik is. And that's the kind of bridge Joseph is. God acts through Joseph to raise up Judah. So in the same way, God acts through the Messiah on the level of the entire world rather than the level of Joseph's generation. Again, Yeshua is the real tzaddik who Joseph is a shadow of. Yeshua helps all of humanity in all generations to reach down inside and bring out something from within, which is a truer expression of humanity, an expression that is the essence of who we are, our name. So this truer expression becomes visible as actions of sacrificial service done in the name of Yeshua that bring glory to God. All the many acts done in the name of Yeshua, these are an expression of our true inner self as humanity. So how does God act through the tzaddik, the Messiah, to accomplish this pushing of humanity, this function of midwife? So first of all, being both God and man, Yeshua is the connection between God and mankind. So that's the foundation. He's both God and man. He can be the bridge. So, but with that important foundation, that fact in mind, God does two things. He sends the Messiah once, and then he sends the Messiah a second time. So the first time, to elevate us, right? He's lifting us up and inspire us to walk a transcendent way. And the second time, to model for us how to live at that higher place. So first time, raise us up. Second time, teach us how to walk up there. How do we act now that we're up there? So let's go through those quickly again. Yeshua's first coming is like Joseph. Okay, his first coming is like Joseph. At his first coming, he was called Yeshua ben Yosef. Since his adoptive father's name was Yosef. So he would have been addressed as Yeshua ben Yosef. His first coming is Mashiach ben Yosef, right? We learn many times the Jewish tradition that there are two messiahs. They're a little confused, and they see Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. And the first one, Yosef, suffers, like Yosef suffered. So at Yeshua's first coming, he opens the pathway to forgiveness, right? He's pulling us up out of the pit through his blood. And he also models for us the righteous, transcendent life. We see him, we say, oh, I want to be like that. That's what the Tzaddik does for his generation. People look at the Tzaddik of that generation and say, oh, boy, I want to be like that. So he's lifting us up out of the pit. He's inspiring us to live that transcendent life and that righteous life. And when we understand that he gave up his life for us, a flame is added in the belly of humanity to reach up for this righteous, transcendent life. We're like, oh my goodness, he died for us. I gotta live the way that he says that we can live. So we're not only inspired by his example, but his death empowers us by touching our emotions. Okay, that's where the real power for action is coming from. But Yeshua comes a second time. And that coming is more like Judah. That coming is more like Judah. He will be known at his second coming as Yeshua ben David, Messiah, son of David. And King David is from the tribe of Judah. So at Yeshua's second coming, he will show us how to live as a king. He'll show us how to live as a king, how to serve consistently, day in, day out for our people, for our nation, for our family, how to rule ourselves, how to manage the affairs of the world on a transcendent level. So Yeshua is both the ultimate Joseph and the ultimate Judah. Yeshua is the epitome of every step of salvation because he is salvation. So let's ask the practical question now. What does this deeper understanding of the text mean to us in practical terms? So first of all, this deeper understanding helps us to see especially Yeshua from a different angle, not to mention Joseph, who is a shadow of Yeshua. So the understandings in this teaching also help us to understand the tension we see playing out throughout the Bible between Joseph and Judah. Second, we can take from this study the encouragement to focus on praise during Hanukkah. The fact that we're reading about Judah during Hanukkah and that the story for the whole year is building toward a critical work in Judah, and Judah's name means praise, that's a kind of biblical support for the Jewish tradition of reading the Hallel at Hanukkah. So let's purpose to do that next Hanukkah. At this special holiday, lower yourself down and acknowledge God's higher place and that he works everything for good in our lives and it's wonderfully miraculous beyond our understanding, right? Just raise your hands and praise to him at Hanukkah. And third, understand that we're crossing a hard line in the calendar and we need to adjust our focus and our sensitivities to how God is working now. Emulate Judah now. Now is the time to rededicate your life as an outward-looking life of service to God and others, right? So just pray that prayer. Lord, I rededicate myself in this season. Show me. Bring it to me. Help me to be creative and to know how I can practically serve people around me in this season and moving ahead in life. So trust that God's going to make it easier for us to put spiritual growth into action now, because this is the season for it. Be looking for ways to do that in this season and be in prayer about it. So that is, step into the energy of the new season. Get in tune with it. It is what God is specially providing for a new season of growth. You know, just as an aside, before we came into the room and recorded here, the pastor here at Southeast brought to us an opportunity for service for our community, which I'm sure the elders will have to talk about and decide whether they want to put it to the people or not. But it's in the air. It's in the air. So lastly today, let's turn to Joshua 5. I have a point to make here, but I'm not going to try to directly connect this Torah portion with this conversation we're having about Joseph and Judah, except to say one thing. God helps us in our walk with him by continually drawing definite lines in the sand. Some obvious, like the Moedim. Each one of those Moedim is a line for us. And some less obvious, like the line between Miketz and Vayigash. You know, there are lines that he's drawing if we can see them. So those lines are mile markers. They help us to gauge our journey. They help to make our journey more solid. And that's important because we're prone to forget and even to doubt what happened to us in the past, how God brought us from one stage to the next. We need these mile markers, and God has designed them into the salvation pattern. So here in Joshua 5, we see one such milestone for a certain generation, the second circumcision. And Tim talked a little bit about that in his teaching part. So this second circumcision seems a bit confusing at first, but it makes a lot of sense if we understand it through the lens of the salvation pattern. On the surface, it looks like a curious lapse in the covenant of circumcision, right? Circumcision, when it's given as a covenant. How could they just say, no, we're not going to circumcise on the eighth day all these newborns in these 40 years? Well, it's a covenant. You can't do that. So Joshua 5 describes that seeming lapse. So let me repeat it one more time here. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haralot. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. So why would it be the case that there was no circumcision during the 40 years in the wilderness? It makes sense when we understand this. Okay, so let me say it clearly. These two generations, the generation that came out of Egypt and the generation that enters the land, these two generations are showing us two halves of a single picture of salvation, two complementary halves of the salvation pattern. Okay, generation one comes out of Egypt. That's the first half, 40 years in the wilderness, dying. Generation two, being born in the wilderness and entering into the land, that's the second half. So within the pattern, there are two circumcisions, not three, two. So the first is done by the father at birth. This is the circumcision that happened for those who came out of Egypt when Israel was a newborn and God was leading them as a strong father, right? God is being so obvious. He's leading them very strongly as the father who protects and provides at that time. In the calendar, this first circumcision is associated with the month of Nisan. In the same way that circumcision has a part in the beginning of the journey, it also has a part at the beginning of the second half of the journey. This second circumcision is the circumcision of the heart, when God is acting more in the capacity of groom rather than father. This second circumcision, so groom meaning Yeshua as acting as our groom. Yeshua is the one who does the second circumcision. It's under his leadership that that is done. And here in Joshua, we're seeing the text imply that Joshua himself does the circumcision, as Tim mentioned. The text literally reads, so Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel. In the calendar, this second circumcision is associated with the month of Tishrei, and particularly the eighth day of Sukkot, right? Circumcision is done on the eighth day. So in the salvation pattern, circumcision is not associated with Shavuot, which is the second of the three pilgrimage festivals, Right? You have unleavened bread, we have Shavuot, and we have Sukkot. Those are the three pilgrimage festivals. And so those are three important points in the pattern, but circumcision is not associated with the second one. So that portion of the cycle is also associated with the wilderness journey. Shavuot, that part of the year, is associated with the 40 years in the wilderness of dying, right? We have the whole 3 weeks in that period of the calendar where the temple is destroyed, all these terrible things happen. Since that part of the salvation pattern doesn't include circumcision, there's no circumcision in the wilderness, okay? God just designed history that way. Again, God is using these two generations of Israel to show one complete picture of salvation. And in that picture, there are only two distinct points of circumcision, with the wilderness journey wedged in between. So I know that was a lot of information. Don't worry about it if you didn't get it, but it makes sense to me anyway. So I don't know if that means anything to anybody. So we'll end there today. Thank you so much for listening. I will include an outline link below the video, as I did last week. Let's focus now on how we can be turning truth into action, the doing with the hands that brings praise, you know, glory to God. That's what this season ahead is all about. So thanks again for listening, and may he make us into the people he wants us to be. Shalom.